Welcome to the Growing Rural Podcast, where we focus on all things rural in South Carolina. We will discuss topics on healthcare, economy, education, and the unique culture that is our rural state. This podcast is supported by the South Carolina Center for Rural and Primary Healthcare. Please join us for today's topic.
Hello, everyone. Welcome back to the Growing Rural Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Kevin Bennett. Our guest today is Johnny Stowe. Mr. Stowe is a wildlife biologist and forester with the Department of Natural Resources, who also manages heritage preserves. So let's begin. So, Johnny, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
So tell us a little bit about yourself and your work with DNR and I guess how you landed in this spot.
Well, I grew up in Northwest Georgia over on the Alabama line, and my daddy was a county extension agent for the University of Georgia, be a counterpart to Clemson Extension here. And I grew up a real small town and hunting and fishing and following daddy around the visiting farmers and worked on farms when I was a kid. And so I'm very much, I guess, a rural person, even though I've worked in Columbia, South Carolina for quite some time. And I worked for the timber company, Bowater Land Company, for a few years planting trees in my early 20s. And then I started to grow up a little bit, and I decided to go to college. So I went to university, went to junior college first. It was Floyd College, and later now it's Georgia Highlands College, and got a really, really good underpinning in the fundamentals. Can't say enough about community colleges.
Right.
They're really wonderful. Right. And then I went to the University of Georgia and got my degree in forestry, my bachelor's in timber management, and then my master's in wildlife management with an emphasis in ecological philosophy. I looked at Aldo Leopold's land ethic and the implications for hunting.
And so then say more about that. That's interesting. So ecological philosophy, is that?
So Aldo Leopold wrote a wonderful little book called A Sand County Almanac, and it has it's changed the world in a lot of ways. It's a wonderful little book of essays, and it's taught in university classes, literature classes, philosophy classes, conservation classes. All the conservation classes have it. All the curricula of conservation biology, wildlife management, and forestry. A Sand County Almanac's a big deal. So Leopold, he was a forester trained at Yale. And he went to the Southwest, New Mexico and Arizona, the early part of the 1900s. And he was very much, he was young. He was just out of college, and he was a big hunter. And so he saw that predators, bears and cougars and wolves were knocking down the deer population they were eating deer and elk and things like that. And so he said, we need to wipe out these predators because we like to hunt, and we'll have more predators if we get, we'll have more prey, we'll have more stuff to hunt if we get rid of the predators. And so he was part of a big campaign that extirpated, that wiped out the grizzly bear, the wolf, the cougar, most black bears in the Pacific Northwest. And then he noticed something. He was, he was a critical thinker. He noticed that all of a sudden there was bad news because the deer population just exploded.
Right.
And it's a classic case study of the Kaibab Plateau, the north rim of the Grand Canyon, that you take predators out and the deer are going to overpopulate. And then the thing is, the deer destroyed their habitat, the deer and the elk. And Leopold said you could ride through the forest and there would not be a leaf, anything green, to the height of a saddle horn.
Because they had eaten it all.
They would rear up on their back legs and eat everything. And so the deer population crashed.
Right.
And so he started thinking about this stuff. And he came up with something, and this developed over the years, over the decades. He later moved to Wisconsin, and he founded the field of wildlife management. He wrote a seminal book called Game Management in 1933. And he was still forming his ideas, though. And Game Management was like I said, a seminal book, but it lacked the nuance and the critical thinking that his later book did. And so over the years, he started thinking about what he called a land ethic. And he said, you know, in ethics, conventional ethics tells us how we should treat each other, whether you have the golden rule that's in many of the great religions, you know, don't do unto people what you don't want done unto you, do unto them what you want them to do unto you. Things like the Ten Commandments, all these rules that are good for us to tell how to, you know, guide us in how to treat each other. He said, but we need something else, not to replace conventional ethics, but we need something that helps us learn how to live as part of nature. Mm-hmm. And he called it his land ethic.
Okay. So that's part of the whole.
That's part of the whole thing. That's part of the way I live my life. And it's a pretty good guide. It's not official DNR policy, but I think you'll find no matter what aspect of DNR you were in, whether it was law enforcement, conservation education, marine fisheries, wildlife management, we all try to be good stewards of the land, and we do have a good land ethic. But the land ethic, Leopold said, is it's a way of thinking in which humans stop looking at the land as a commodity just to be used, but look at it as the land as being a community of which we're a part. And he had a golden rule, and he said a thing is right ecologically when it tends to protect, to preserve the integrity, and that's the wholeness of the health, the stability, and that's, you know, balance, resilience, and the beauty of the land. And he said the land is the soils and the waters and the plants and the animals, and the land also includes people.
And you said part of a community, so that everybody benefits from, or I guess doesn't benefit if it goes poorly, right?
Absolutely.
If it's not managed correctly.
Absolutely. It's, you know, ethics, Leopold had talked about ethics as, you know, a truly ethical thing, and he was talking about hunting when he talked about it. He said, you know, when a hunter's out in the woods by him or herself, you know, the things they do, nobody would ever know. And he said, true ethics is doing the right thing when no one would ever know if you did the wrong thing.
Right.
And that's true ethics. But from a more utilitarian view, you know, we teach our children, you know, we teach, there's such a simple lesson. We teach all our kids this, and they understand it right away. It makes perfect sense. But it's a lesson that can be writ large on our role in nature. And that's just the simple, you know, don't kill the goose that lays the golden eggs.
Right.
And nature, you know, we're dependent on it. Humans are an inextricably linked part of nature, and the way we treat nature benefits us in the long run or comes back to bite us.
Right, which I think we're starting to see glimmers of that around the country and the world. So this reminds me somewhat of the Native American ethic that we always learned about in school, about how they respected the land, used all the bits, had some utility, didn't kill if they didn't need to. If the Native Americans had this concept, it sounds like it's similar to a wildlife management, a land ethic, community. You know, how do you think that got lost, and why is it that we didn't get rediscovered, I guess, until the 30s on and onward?
When Europeans came to this country, it was looked at as a frontier. You know, when people came out and when there were 50, 65 million buffalo on the Great Plains, and the buffalo came all the way to South Carolina. They were up in places like Rock Hill. And, of course, nobody could stand in one place and see all the 65 million buffalo at one time. But you know, when people walked out onto these, when you were on a hill or something, you were looking out at these Great Plains, and it was just black dots everywhere, and there were just countless buffalo. People had the idea we could, you know, conservation was just it was not a,
right.
It
so
was like
overabundance.
How could we ever knock a dent in it? And we should have known better, because I mean, you go back to the Bible, you know, and it talks about being a good steward to the earth. You know, it talks about, if you know, how to harvest animals, you know, in the very first part of the Old Testament. So we've known these things for a long time, and you look at the ancient societies, you know, the Mesopotamia, the land between the, you know, the Fertile Crescent, you know, it used to be, you know, that used to be rich land, and it was all farmed to death. But we did lose that when we came here. You know, it's sad. It takes, you know, soil, you know, that living matrix of minerals and microbes and decaying plant and organic matter, the soil that, you know, all life depends on, It's composed of two general things: organic matter, you know, life that dies and rots, and then mineral soil, you know, minerals that break down from rocks. The mineral part of soil that breaks down from rocks takes about 1,000 years to build up just about 0.5 inch of it. And so, okay.
Very slow.
When we had cotton farming in the South, through most of the South, we didn't do it sustainably. People would have a farm, and they'd wear out the soil, and then they'd move next door. And of course, that was bad for a lot of reasons. But you know, through the King Cotton and the concomitant creek bank to creek bank plowing, we sent a lot of the topsoil down to the bottom of the rivers and the oceans.
It washed away.
Yeah. And so, yeah, we're having to build that stuff back, and it's a slow process.
Right, and all in the name of the dollar, because it made a lot of money.
Yeah, it was short-sighted.
Right. So you mentioned that you manage heritage preserves. It sounds like this type of concept, the heritage preserve, would fit in with that ethic. Is that right?
So the Department of Natural Resources, our role, and of course we have a long mission statement, but the long and short of it is that the Department of Natural Resources in South Carolina is the principal, serves as the principal advocate for and protector of the state's natural resources. Mm-hmm. And we through law enforcement, you know, making sure people are obeying the game laws and not polluting, not dumping things in creeks and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
As well as environmental education and, helping to make recommendations to the legislature to set laws on a lot of different things that affect natural resources. We do that, but we also own land. We, the state of South Carolina, the 4.5 million people in our state, own a lot of land, and that's the DNR is responsible for managing for the citizens about 280,000 acres of land in the state, and it's all open to the public. That's what it's for. It's there to protect nature, but also to provide benefits to people, not just clean air and water, but places to recreate, to hunt, to fish, to hike, to bird watch.
These protected areas that you can actually see what the natural environment really
absolutely
should be.
And they tend to be of two types. You know, we have some public lakes, but the lands that I'm more familiar with are either wildlife management areas or heritage preserves. And some heritage preserves are also wildlife management areas. So wildlife management areas are areas that are they're set aside to protect special places, special landscapes, whether it's swamps or marshes or places in the mountains and everything in between. And a big emphasis on them is the hunting part. Heritage preserves, in my view, and of course I'm biased, they're a little more special. My colleagues would probably disagree with me a little bit on that, but heritage preserves are, a lot of them are also wildlife management areas. So most heritage preserve acreage we also hunt, but some of it we don't. For instance, there might be a small heritage preserve a couple acres on the edge of Charleston or something that's just not practical to hunt. But any of the heritage preserves where it's practical to hunt, we do have hunting.
Okay.
But heritage preserves, and this is something every South Carolinian should be really grateful for. So most states have a heritage trust program. The first one was formed here in South Carolina in 1976. So our legislature, in its wisdom, looked around and saw the special things in South Carolina and said, we need to give some of these places really special protection. You know, it's great that we've got national wildlife refuges and national forest and state forest and state parks, but there's a little something else that we need. And so they formed the Heritage Trust Program, and it was set up to protect endangered species and imperiled ecosystems, as well as unique geological forms and things like that. So that was the natural side of heritage preserves. And then the other side of heritage preserve protection is cultural areas, so historic archaeological sites, things like that. And so that's what the Heritage Trust Program does. And we've got about 80,000 acres of land in the Heritage Trust Program now.
When you're talking about natural resources, obviously a lot of those are going to be in rural areas, parts of the state, because otherwise they wouldn't be natural resources anymore. How is your interaction and DNR's interaction with those residents of those rural areas?
Everything we do, you know, we're public servants, DNR is, and so everything we do, we answer to all the citizens of the state of South Carolina, but We tend to take a special interest in, you know, what's local to us. So if we acquire a tract of land to manage for the state, then we're especially interested in being good neighbors.
So do you have a sense for residents in these rural communities? Do you think they have a better sense of this land ethic we talked about earlier than urban residents, or is it a mix, or what's your sense of that?
I hate to be categorical about it. Country folks, they definitely have a better sense of ecology, what's going on in the landscape around them. Mm-hmm. And they tend to have a better land ethic. But, you know, some of the people that I know that have the best land ethics of all live right here in the middle of Columbia. You know, there was a philosopher, Holmes Ralston, and he wrote a wonderful paper. It was in the Journal of Environmental Ethics about 1980, and I don't remember all the nuance of it, but the paper was Can and Ought We to Follow Nature? And he split the landscape up into three facets. He said you have the wild facet, and then you have the rural facet, mm-hmm. and then you have the urban facet. Mm-hmm. And he had definitions for them, and those definitions would have been different here than they would have where he was talking about out west. Mm-hmm. But, you know, wildlands are lands that, you know, I tend to think of wildlands, you don't have a whole lot of roads. Mm-hmm. You don't have a whole lot of houses. When you come into more of the rural areas, you know, you got more roads and houses. You know, we don't have any great big wilderness areas in South Carolina. You know, we have places like the Okefenokee in Georgia and some up in the Blue Ridge Mountains. But you can think of most of South Carolina as being rural. You could make a pretty good case that South Carolina is a rural state as a whole. Another philosopher, Roderick Nash, he was talking about wilderness areas, and he said wilderness is a state of mind. It's not just an area that, you know, is big without a lot of roads where, you know, human impacts are not great. Mm-hmm. And I think you can make the same statement for being rural. You know, mm-hmm. the rural is, it's a state of mind. You know, I know folks that live way out in the country and, you know, they're not interested in gardening or hunting or fishing or hiking and all. And, you know, what they love to do is come to the city and see the symphony and museums and all. And of course, that's wonderful, too.
Right. Yeah, there's all kinds.
Think about two simple definitions. Aldo Leopold, in a Sand County Almanac, he posed the question, who wrote the rules for progress? Mm-hmm. And you think about it, we've tended to think about progress as being, you know, increased GDP and things like that. And, of course, a growing economy is vital to, you know, our way of life. But at some point, having areas that aren't developed is going to be more important to human society for a lot of reasons, mm-hmm. for human well-being, human welfare, than having you know, development. You think about if you had a landscape, a frontier, and I think this is how we get into. I think it's kind of a trap. If you had a frontier, and you have a little village, and there's 10 people there, I think the mindset would tend to be we've only got two kids in this whole village. You know, if we can get, you know, 100 people in a village, we can entice a country doctor to come live here.
Right.
If we can get 40 kids in a village, we can get a school teacher to come here. And so it was kind of the idea of more growth is always better.
Right.
And there's a lot of validity to that, but at some point, you know, where do we cross the line?
Yeah, you cross the threshold of.
Yeah, and of course, I don't have the answer, you know, to what that threshold is. It's a matter of values. It's a matter of society. And ever since 1976, you know, when our legislature set aside, made the Heritage Trust Program, and that Heritage Trust Program has been copied all over the United States. We were the first one. We had the first, still do have the first heritage preserve in the whole nation, 40 Acre Rock Heritage Preserve up in Lancaster County.
You shared with me a PowerPoint, a set of PowerPoint slides that showed, I think, that concept of, you know, I think it was housing density and how that has changed over the U.S. over the years. And it's really striking. And we'll put it in the show notes so folks listening along can check in on that. But talk about that a little bit in that context.
Yeah, I believe that it was U.S. Forest Service graphic that came from some geographers out of the University of Wisconsin. And it was of the Southeast. And the way they defined the Southeast was Texas up to, I guess, through Virginia. It was four maps. It was the same map, and it showed 1940, 1970, 2000 and then 2030. What's striking about it is they had different colors for housing density. And I think housing density, you can think of impervious surface. So impervious surface is, you know, where a roof is or concrete or pavement, right, where when a drop of water hits, it cannot run into the ground, so it runs off somewhere. So impervious surface or housing density. So the map showed 1940, and if y'all can see that, you see the little red dot, that's Atlanta. And then due east of Atlanta here in Columbia, and then you can see Charleston, you can see Greenville, you can see Charlotte, you can see Birmingham.
But there's very few red dots.
Yeah, and then you go from 1940 to 1970, and you can see Atlanta start growing.
And this, I imagine, too, is the interstate effect. 1940, there were no interstates, right?
That's right. That was Eisenhower. Right. So, yeah.
So that started collecting and connecting these urban centers.
I'd never thought about that. That's exactly right.
You can see
right.
it lighting up there in the southeast corridor there.
And then 1970, it starts getting a lot of red. And then go to 2030. And so that, when you see that red, that pretty much everything red is not rural. And that's depressing to me, you know, for a lot of reasons.
And that's a loss of these natural resources, tree cover,
all these
areas.
You know, when you have, say, a bottomland hardwood forest, if you have a flood, if we have a big flood up in North Carolina and the water runs down and it gets to that preserve where there's big trees, and not just big living trees, but dead trees laying on the ground and bushes and all, that water has to slow down to go through that area. And also, the water's cleaner. So a lot of the when the water slows down, a lot of the sediment falls out of it.
Right.
The water down on the other end is when it comes out below the preserve, it's cleaner. And also, it mitigates, lessens the severity of floods and droughts. So if you have an intact forest, when the water gets to it, it slows it down. So if you're downstream, the flood's not going to be as intense. It's not going to rise. The waters aren't going to rise as high or as quickly. But, you know, a big part of what I do, my major passion professionally is prescribed fire. And I don't want to get going too much on that because, you know, that we could easily do many episodes on that. But prescribed fire is one of the best tools we have to manage land here in South Carolina. For the past 14 or 15,000 years, this landscape of South Carolina has burned. From lightning fires, and then also from Native Americans burning the woods. Later on, the Celtic and other European settlers and African American settlers that were here, everybody's always burned the woods. And then about in the 1920s, the federal government started coming down with a all fires bad policy.
Right.
And that went through the Dixie Crusaders and on through Smokey Bear and all. So when you don't burn in this part of the world where you have pretty rich soil, you're pretty close to the equator, you're low elevation, you got a warm climate, things grow. We got a long growing season and it's getting longer. And so vegetation builds up. And in a lot of these areas, it's not a matter of if they're going to burn, it's a matter of when. And so with prescribed fire is a legal use of fire that's carefully planned, and permitted and done in a prescribed fashion under certain weather and other socio-ecological conditions. We actually light the woods up, control burning, prescribed burning.
Right.
And so we reduce fuel loads, which actually it may seem a paradox, you know, but by burning the woods, we can reduce fuel loads and actually increase public safety. And, of course, we burn for economic reasons, so that we don't have to spend money putting fires out. You know, there's less wildfire if you have more prescribed fire.
And
ecology is the main thing.
And this knocks down the vegetation, the dead wood, returns it back to the soil, and allows it to regrow in a healthy way, right?
Absolutely. And a lot of the ecosystems in South Carolina, especially a lot of the wildlife management areas and heritage preserves, absolutely have to have fire. So there's certain things on there that if they don't have fire, they just disappear.
Right.
It's not like they would lack a little bit of fire. It's absolutely imperative.
When you're talking about this being connected, I've gotten a sense for myself and from others that a lot of times you're connected with a place as well. And I've wondered about this dichotomy between wilderness and rural folks who have grown up in smaller areas. If they have almost a stronger connection to that place than folks who live in cities. And, you know, this is pure hypothesis, but I'm wondering what your thoughts are on that.
I think it's yes and no. My ancestors have lived, I've got my little piece of land in Georgia, and my ancestors have been there many generations, you know, and I go there and I see the subsoil and the bedrock, and I know that, you know, because of poor farming practices, and they were doing what society did at that time.
They were
good, you know, upstanding people, but, you know, they were farming in a way that we know now is not the best way to do it, and they were sending the topsoil down to the ocean and all. And so, you know, that piece of land, especially my homeland, I love it, in spite of, you know, the things that were not good, that you know, ecologically and socially, I love it in spite of those things. It goes way back, and I feel a deep responsibility, not just as a person who owns some land in Georgia, but as a person who people came here, hundreds of years ago and impacted this landscape a lot. I feel a personal responsibility to fix a little bit of it back. You know, every human that lives, we all consume resources. We have to. That's, you know, to live, we have to consume things. And but I think if each of us looked at, you know, little ways that how in our lives we can in little ways give a little bit back, whether it's buying a hunting and fishing license, whether you hunt or fish or not, just to support DNR, whether it's been a little bit more conscientious on recycling, whether it's hey, I'm going to turn the water off while I'm brushing my teeth. You know, the little things, they do add up. And not only do they add up, if you do the same things with the same people over and over, same time of year, the same places, especially when you do them with family, and then you do them with different generations so that it's carried on, well, that, Kevin, that is culture. And so culture is not just the things of the past. Culture is not just the heritage of the past. Culture and heritage is the past, and it's what we do right now. And the culture of the future is dependent on not just the past, but what we do right now. And we can shape culture, and we are shaping culture. Everything we do shapes the culture of the future. We've got everything we need to make the world a better place. And if we don't have natural resources, it's kind of like a pyramid. You know, if you don't have that foundation, you know, you ain't got no pyramid.
You were just talking about, I guess, essentially passing these concepts down to younger generations. What else does DNR do for kids and outreach and education?
Working with kids is a huge part of what we do. So people like me, it's not part of my job description to work with kids. But, you know, when kindergarten teachers call or somebody calls, you know, I go. The biggest partnership I have is with Dobie's Mill Elementary in Kershaw County, and but we have folks, and that's all they do. Their job is they run fishing rodeos, and part law enforcement's a big part of that, of course. Our game wardens,
right?
But we have people that go around to schools, and that's what they do. And there's a big demand for it. And then part of it, you know, is just mentoring. You know, we encourage, you know, by providing places for people to hunt and fish, we encourage them, you know, take your kids with you. And the legislature's been real good to add extra days on to some of the hunting seasons. We have a wonderful group of people. It's our diversity program at DNR. And I brought one of these coloring books here, and it's a bilingual coloring book, Exploring South Carolina's Outdoors with SCDNR. And we can get those out to folks if they want them. 50 years ago, you know, the quintessential people that hunted and fished, it was all men. And you think about the average hunter or fisherman, we tend to think of a white or black man, you know, middle-aged or older. We're trying to get more people engaged in the outdoors. And so you know, we have a growing population. Our brothers and sisters from Central America, their populations are growing. And, you know, we're getting more and more of our officers and other people that can speak Spanish. And that's a good thing, too. So, you know, multicultural, intergenerational, and that's the key to the future, no matter what you're doing in life, I think.
Yeah, it all goes hand in hand. Well, Johnny, this has been a great conversation. I've learned a lot, and I love your perspective on all of this. I hope a lot of folks have learned a lot as well, and or maybe relearn some things that they knew in the back of their mind, but they hadn't paid attention to in a long time. So where can people learn more about you and your work, the DNR work, and everything else that we talked about today?
Well, we have a wonderful website, of course, DNR does, to give a plug to my colleague, Sean Taylor, the archaeologist for DNR. You know, DNR, we protect, wild lands for recreation and hunting and fishing, but we also have these wonderful cultural areas, preserves that are set aside for, and Sean has a lot of digs that people can go on, so you can actually go on an excavation and be part of, digging up some piece of history and recording it in a professional fashion. So we have that, and we've got over a quarter of a million acres of land that we manage. It belongs to the state, to the citizens of South Carolina, and we're always happy, when people come in from out of state to use our lands and spend their money here and then go home.
But the
people that we really care about when it comes to Department of Natural Resources lands are the citizens of the state. So we have, you can look up our lands on our website, and I work mainly in the PD region from Rock Hill down to Little PD River, and you can find my publications online. If you Google me, I do a lot of writing and speaking, and
we'll put some links to some of that in our show notes so people can find it.
That'll be good, and it's not part of my DNR work, but I do teach yoga. I teach ecological yoga. It's based on the rhythms and patterns and parallels in nature, and how that connects to society and the human experience. And so you can find me online under Sayanidra Eco Yoga.
That's all for today. So check our show notes for the links for everything we talked about today, and stay tuned for more episodes coming out soon. If you have any ideas for guests or any other topics you'd like for us to cover, please let us know. We'd love to hear from you. So thanks for listening.
Thanks for listening to the Growing Rural Podcast. If you found the content valuable, please leave a rating on iTunes or Spotify so others can find us. For more information, please visit our website at sc.edu/ruralhealthcare or follow us on Twitter at sc_CRPH. This was recorded at the University of South Carolina School of Medicine in Columbia. It is edited and produced by Sean Riffle. Y'all take care.